This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Powered by U Mobile. 5G now with you.
Good morning. You're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Shazana Mokhtar. According to the United Nations, global smoking rates are on a decline, dropping from 22.7% in 2007 to 15.7% in 2019. However, 80% of smokers currently reside in low and middle income countries where the burden on the healthcare system is heaviest. How much progress have we made to reduce preventable illness caused by smoking? And are we equipped to deal with the risks stemming from the fast rising use of alternative nicotine products? Joining me to discuss this to mark World No Tobacco Day on May 31st is Ben Yudan, director at the New Zealand nonprofit group Action for a Smoke-Free 2025, also known as ASH New Zealand, and Azrul Muhammad Khalib, CEO of the Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy. Gentlemen, good morning and welcome to the show.
Good morning, Shazana.
Good morning.
So can we start with your observations on the evolution of societal attitudes towards tobacco and smoking, both in the global and country-specific contexts? What do you see as the biggest driver in the perception of tobacco products from being seen as desirable to undesirable? So maybe we can start with Ben.
Well, there's been an enormous shift, particularly in developing nations and OECD countries, towards policies that have dramatically devalued the cigarette. So starting off with advertising bans as early in the 60s and 70s, heavy taxation policies in New Zealand and Australia and Ireland, I believe, we have big pictorial warnings on cigarettes. We banned the advertising and the display in shops. And so cigarettes are now almost invisible unless you are somebody who smokes and wants to buy a cigarette. And I think that is, for us, it's got our youth smoking rates down to under a percent. And we've had the greatest gains in young smokers because we've just had almost a generation now of gradually just removing cigarettes from sight and mind, unless you're somebody who's actively seeking them out to sustain a nicotine addiction.
Making cigarettes invisible to the public. Azrul, what do we know about smoking trends here in Malaysia and whether measures like taxes and pictorial warnings are having an impact on smoking prevalence?
For this, you know, I would refer to Malaysia's smoking prevalence. You started off by talking about how it's declined globally. If you look at Malaysia, we find that it's hovering around 21%. And has been for several years. In one sense, it may seem almost acceptable or normal to say it, that it is around 21%. But when you look at the breakdown of the national data, it actually reveals that almost half of all men in Malaysia smoke cigarettes. I think it's around 47% or something like that. And around 1% of women smoke. Out of that we find that surveys find 17.4% of children aged 13 to 15 smoke, and 1 in 10 of those aged younger than 12 have already lit up a cigarette. So, you know, it's something that's necessary today for us to look at where we have come from when it comes to cigarettes and where we're heading off to. And unfortunately, when it comes to cigarette smoking, it's not changed much. In fact, to some extent, we find that there is, thankfully, a low percentage of women who smoke cigarettes. But amongst men, there has been really not much of a change over the past several years.
Why do you think that is, Azrul? Why are there segments in the community that I suppose are persistent smokers, despite efforts to, as Ben put it, remove cigarettes from public consciousness?
Well, it's a little bit different because we don't have the necessarily legal frameworks that help create a undesirable environment of smoking. And, you know, I'm old enough to experience and remember, and I'm sure Ben is too, of the days when you traveled on an airplane and people were smoking in the smoking section and non-smoking section, and that was able to be now banished into history simply because there are now legislation that prohibits smoking on airplanes. And also Not too long ago, we thought about how pubs, bars could not possibly be without people smoking as part of the ambience and the environment. But a lot of places in Europe now are absent of cigarette smoke, and people are smoking their ciggies, cigars, and so forth outside of the establishment. So, you know, it's becoming more and more, not to say hostile towards the smoker, but it's more that people prefer to have smoke-free environments today as compared to maybe, you know, 10 years in the past. So it is possible to imagine a situation where we push back against this acceptability of smoking, but you need the legal frameworks. And unfortunately, in the Malaysian context, we don't have these legal frameworks. And also culturally, it's still very much part of the culture and the value of people, you know, associating it with stress, with dealing with tension, looking macho, being a man, and also being accepted into social circles.
Right. So you talk about how cigarettes in Malaysia, they are still quite, prevalent in the way we communicate or interact or in our cultural situations. Ben, I'm wondering if from your perspective and in New Zealand, do you see smoking becoming an issue of economic class? Did you see like a division between those who smoke and those who don't? Is that being, divided along economic class lines? And does this complicate efforts then to eradicate smoking and its harms?
Very much so. So in the last 10 years, we've seen smoking rates here almost half. We have about 8% of adults smoke daily now, which is a record low. We've seen some of the biggest drops in recent years. However, that decline in smoking's not been fair, and it's not been equitable, because we're now in a situation where 7 out of every 10 smokers in New Zealand now lives in the poorest communities in New Zealand, compared to half a decade ago. So we've done incredibly well with the more affluent populations. New Zealand is quite a culturally diverse population, so European New Zealanders as well have done extremely well, have very low smoking rates, whereas we still have higher smoking rates for our Pacific Island population and for our indigenous Māori population, and particularly women who smoke at around 2 or 3 times the rates of Europeans as well. So there still is quite a considerable issue around inequity. And I think some of that, I think Aswald touched on it as well, is because for people who live in a lower socioeconomic community, maybe a working sort of shift work, trying to get the kids to school, trying to sort of manage quite a complex life without much support. Often when we talk to people in those communities to understand what's happening around smoking, they say, my cigarettes, my 10 minutes to myself to step outside the house on the deck and have a break. So there's, I think, important that now we're getting down to these kind of smoking being much more about those populations. We need to understand, yes, there's an issue around addiction and nicotine keeping them on the smoking, but actually, what are the other factors that for them smoking is providing, that despite them knowing it's you know, very likely to be the thing that's going to give them heart disease or cancer or result in death and illness, they still continue to want to do it because they see a positive to it? And how do we work in a much more kind of empathetic way to help people to come off the cigarettes that supports all of the quite aggressive pushes that we've had, such as very, very high tax, strong anti-smoking campaigns, sort of stigmatization of the behavior, because actually there's people at the end of this who are stuck smoking, and we need to kind of care for them and understand what's going on in their lives. And that, I think, is the more successful we've been here, that's much more where the challenge now sits.
I want to bring in New Zealand laws, because in December last year, New Zealand became the first country in the world to pass an anti-smoking law that prohibits the sale of tobacco products to people born after January 2009. So that's effectively putting in place what's called the generational endgame for smoking, something that is also being mulled here in Malaysia. I mean, how controversial was this legislation when it was introduced in New Zealand? And what factors influenced the enactment of what's seen as a pretty radical policy move by the rest of the world?
Well, I don't think it's been considered controversial at all here. And there's a few reasons for that. It's part of a suite of measures. And included in that is removing the nicotine from cigarettes by 2025. So then they're no longer addictive. And that would probably have been the more controversial measure, and dramatically reducing the number of places that cigarettes can be purchased from around 6,000 nationwide to 600. So essentially a 90% reduction. The smoke-free generation is seen less of a driver of reducing smoking rates and more about sustaining low smoking rates, because we already have very, very low smoking rates in young people and who are underage. Some of the biggest declines in the last decade have been the youngest groups. So we're looking at less than 1% now of under 18 smoking in New Zealand. So the smoke-free generation is less around something which is going to continue to drive down youth smoking, but more around something that is going to sustain those low rates, which will be achieved by other measures. And the other thing I would sort of add into the mix here that the government has used as a tool is also looking at harm reduction as well, and looking at how less harmful forms of nicotine than the cigarette, so in particular vaping, is allowed here. So the government's taken an approach where they see that as a tool to help adult smokers to quit smoking as well. So the smoke-free generation is around keeping those smoking rates really low down at the front, whereas the focus of the legislation is around our remaining adults, largely those who are in the lower socioeconomic groups, Māori, Pacific, to support them and to stop smoking and then keep those rates down.
Azrul, after listening to Ben's explanation, I'm wondering whether we in Malaysia were too ambitious in announcing a generational endgame plan for smoking, given the circumstantial differences compared to New Zealand. Yeah, our smoking prevalence rates are much higher, and at the moment we don't even have a standalone law governing tobacco controls.
You know, it's been a roller coaster ride when it comes to the tobacco and smoking control bill. As we know, Malaysia does not yet have a primary legislation that has regulatory powers in terms of managing tobacco products and, of course, vape. You know, so we've been depending very much on the Food Act. The Food Act of 1983 is where all the tobacco product regulations, its amendments and sub-regulations and so forth lie under. And it has been pointed out, these are the same laws, you know, which govern nasi lemak production, manufacturing of soft drinks, alcoholic beverages and packaging of chicken and eggs, you know. So with the introduction and the wide adoption of vaping, which is also now a nicotine delivery device, we find that the regulations as we have them today are no longer fit for purpose. They're struggling and possibly you could even say obsolete to some extent. So we need a new piece of legislation, and it was felt that since we need this piece of legislation that's been worked on for more than 13 years, we've been trying to get this thing off the ground, let's put in vape there as well so that we can do it all at one go, right? And this is a piece of legislation that's been worked on by different governments, different civil servants and so forth. So originally, it didn't have a GEG provision. That was actually introduced under the previous health minister. And it was definitely something that drew inspiration from New Zealand, obviously, and looking at trying to address in a bold, audacious, arguably, a move to see about drastically bringing down the smoking prevalence rate by way of a legal measure. And, you know, and this is where Malaysia is sort of an uphill climb compared to countries which have lower prevalence rate. Many of the other countries that are actually considering a similar measure, you know, they have less than 10% of their population that currently smoke, whereas Malaysia is around 21. So yes, it is something of a tricky and risky move, because the perception that was given was that we're out to get smokers and vapors and so forth. And I like that Ben emphasized on the empathetic approach here, because we shouldn't be looking out to punish and penalize people who smoke and vape. You know, that's not what this legislation is intended to be. It should be about closing the gate against new generations of smokers and vapors amongst those who are born after a certain year, and looking at trying to help reduce the number of people who are vaping and smoking in the country by making it hard for them to take up the habit to begin with. So the fact of the matter is that, yes, it was a bold vision that was introduced, but I don't see that it is impossible to have that. It really takes a lot of courage. It takes a lot of audacity to try to get that through Parliament, because politically it's sticky and it may not have the kind of support that it needs. And from a socioeconomic angle as well, this has economic considerations as well, seeing how this is part of the industries that contribute towards the Malaysia's economic growth and so forth. So a lot of people see this legislation as a threat.
So how do you counter those concerns that regulation is an economic threat? Because there is a strong industry lobby.
When you look at the economic angle, for every one ringgit that we collect through the excise duties imposed on tobacco products, we are spending 4 ringgit more in health-related costs, you know. And to treat chronic diseases such as lung cancer, dealing with COPD and so forth, you know. So when you add on the fact that almost 20,000 people die prematurely as a result of these illnesses, surely we should be able to imagine a way for us to be able to have a healthier population, you know, and we, perhaps this is one way to go about it, because today there is nothing, you know, in place to regulate vape, for example. It's a total vacuum, and children are already taking up vaping, and most of it's most likely with nicotine, and they're becoming addicted to nicotine a lot earlier. And this is a very worrying development for which we have no legal remedy or approach. So we need this legislation to come in, not next year, not 5 years from now or 10 years from now. We need it today.
I'm speaking to Ben Yudan of ASH New Zealand and Azrul Muhammad Khalib of the Galen Centre in a panel discussion to mark World No Tobacco Day. When we come back, we'll explore the different policy approaches towards alternative nicotine products in New Zealand and Malaysia. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to The Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile. 5G now with you.
Thanks for staying tuned to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Shazana Mokhtar, and with me today to mark World No Tobacco Day are Ben Yudan, director at the New Zealand non-profit group Action for a Smoke-Free 2025, and Azrul Muhammad Khalib, CEO of the Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy. Turning back to Ben, Azrul earlier was talking about shifting the policy focus from just tobacco products to all nicotine-based products, including vape. How is this policy playing out in New Zealand? What kind of regulations have you put in place when it comes to alternative nicotine-based products to cigarettes?
Yeah, so there's two ways nicotine is regulated here. It's as tobacco and vaping products and medicinal purposes. We're very fortunate in that we have what Azrul is calling for. We have a single piece of legislation that has covered all of our sort of smoke-free legislation for about 30 years now. And it's been that legislation which sort of constantly gets updated with new measures, which has meant, you know, we have quite a sort of simple one place that we deal with everything. So for until 2020, we had no regulations or legislation on vaping at all. And that's when we saw very rapid rises, particularly for young people, although we said we really did need to have something to regulate it. However, what we also said was that we needed to get a balance right, because we were seeing very good evidence domestically and internationally and through clinical trials here that adult smokers who were using vapes to quit smoking were achieving quite high success rates. And at a population level, we've seen huge declines in smoking, which correlate with increase in vaping, with a lot of the adult populations who've smoked at very high levels in the past. And our government also is very much of the view that there's quite a strong body of evidence that vaping is considerably less harmful than smoking. And so for people who absolutely can't quit smoking, there's an option there that's going to dramatically reduce the risk they're going to die as a consequence of smoking. Ideally, they ultimately do neither, but it's part of a harm reduction pathway. So when the government then finally legislated on vaping, they put some controls around the amount of nicotine, who could sell it, stopped it being advertised and marketed in the same way. It was a bit too late, unfortunately, but put some quite strong controls around it, but kept it as a consumer product. Medicinal nicotine would be like nicotine gum or patches and stop smoking treatments. And then after sort of doing that, and the government said, well, actually, we see that vaping probably is an enabler of us putting in much, much more aggressive legislation around cigarettes. And it was because of that, they said, well, actually, we think we could legislate to take the nicotine out of cigarettes and make cigarettes much less available, because as well as trying to reach our end game of getting adult smoking rates under 5% in the next 2 or 3 years, we also see that there's an opportunity here to address the fact that it's easier to buy cigarettes at high nicotine levels than it is to buy vapes, which are less harmful. And so we need to penalise the most dangerous form of nicotine, which is the one that comes with a cigarette, because whilst it's the nicotine that keeps someone using it, it's the tar and the smoke that kills people from setting fire to tobacco and inhaling it. And so our legislation was passed with a view of dramatically redressing the balance, really, and making it very clear that cigarettes are the most harmful form. They are the single most deadly drug in New Zealand, and that they need to be rapidly controlled and access reduced, but also in a way that understands there's always going to be people who are going to struggle from withdrawal when they can't get them, and are going to need access to some kind of alternate to help manage those withdrawal symptoms as well. Because if you took nicotine away from, and we have a much smaller population than you do in Malaysia, but if you took nicotine away from 300,000 people overnight, I think the country would fall over and grind to a halt, because you'd have so many people dealing with withdrawal symptoms. So being able to support those people and have alternatives available to them has very much been part of our government's strategy.
Why not just limit, I guess, vape to prescription vape then, Ben? I mean, if it is to help those who are cigarette smokers to wean off that, I mean, I think many people could support that move from cigarettes to vape. So why not just restrict it to that group entirely?
Yeah, it's a very understandable idea, but I think it also has a lot of problems. Firstly, the US has attempted a sort of halfway house between what we have and that, whereby the Food and Drug Administration must approve vape products to be sold. To date, they've had 23 million applications and approved 23 products.
The US model has basically discovered that a system requires a higher level of regulation, and a sort of pseudo-medicalized pharmaceutical model has put in huge barriers in terms of getting legitimate vape products out to the population, and very much worked in favor of the tobacco industry manufacturers, which was not necessarily something that that a lot of people wanted. The other issue with the pharmaceutical model is coming back to the fact that particularly in countries like New Zealand, the US, Australia, which has just done a pharmaceutical model, the majority of smokers are now those people who are less well off, living rurally, living in populations which already have very low access to healthcare, much less likely to be prescribed existing drugs that they need. And so a pharmaceutical model is putting a much less harmful product into a system that's already failing the people who are smoking. And I think creates much bigger barriers to them for accessing a much safer alternate than the barriers to them just going down to the shop and buying some cigarettes. So I think there's real concerns about putting them into the pharmaceutical model, because it essentially just creates huge barriers to safe products, but leaves cigarettes absolutely everywhere, which is the thing we definitely don't want. And particularly for those people who already have quit smoking and might be using a vape to manage withdrawal, suddenly they can't go and buy the product that they found has worked for them to keep them off cigarettes, but they can pop down to the shop at the corner of their street and just buy their cigarettes without having to make an appointment, find a pharmacy, find the right product. So I think it's a well-intentioned policy, but I think while cigarettes are still ubiquitous, it's one that's just deeply unfair.
Azrul, I know that on your part, you're not convinced about the harm reduction qualities of vape that's available here in Malaysia. Would you be calling for an outright ban of vape? Or is the cat out of the bag given the proliferation of the Malaysian vape industry amid the current legal lacunae when it comes to nicotine products?
I think the ship has sailed on whether or not we would want to ban vape in a similar way that Thailand and Singapore have. But I really need to be able to respond to some of the comparisons that have been made with countries like New Zealand, Australia, and the UK, especially here in Malaysia, which the Public Health England papers have been waved about and demonstrated as proof that vape is safer than cigarettes. For one thing, we can't compare Malaysia with these countries in terms of the usage of vape in these countries. And for one reason, which is rarely mentioned by the industry, which is nicotine concentration. Cigarettes, typically, they're around 1 to 3 milligrams of nicotine. When you look at the vape liquids in disposables, which have nicotine, they are found to have a range between 1, 3, and 5% strength. In fact, I was just digging up my drawer the other day and found one had 6.8%, you know, and in these other countries that have regulated vape and has made it available for different purposes, such as a form of nicotine replacement therapy, almost as a way to come off cigarettes. In these countries, the maximum strength permitted is around 20 milligrams, so 2%. You know, you can't get the kind of strengths that we regularly are able to access at street corners, at roadside stalls, in the pasar malams, you know, the markets, the night markets and so forth. You can't get these concentrations in these countries. And the toxicity of nicotine is around 60 milligrams or 6%. And a recent visit to a vape expo that was held at a hotel recently also showed a difference in terms of the puffs that are available. You know, the disposables in the Malaysian market is around maybe 200 to even 3,000 puffs with different nicotine strength. And some of them are priced as low as 10 ringgit. And, you know, when you look at the measure, 200 puffs are equivalent to around 13 to 30 cigarettes. And studies show that people take an average around 140 puffs per day. And the fact is that with vape, it is more likely that you are taking more puffs than you would regularly take if you were smoking a cigarette. From a cost economic perspective, the prices being lower and it's not taxed at the moment or regulated in every way, and nicotine content higher than a pack of cigarettes, I'm not surprised that almost 5% of the Malaysian population are now estimated to be vaping.
Ben, over in New Zealand, as Azrul said, the nicotine levels in the products there are lower than what we find here. But there is still the concern that teenagers and young people are being exposed to it, that they can get hold of it a lot easier and hence create this nicotine addiction cycle. So what is being done there in terms of addressing or preventing teenagers from taking up vaping?
New Zealand has seen quite a big increase in young people who are vaping. That increase happened up until 2020 when we had no legislation around vaping. So it was a bit of a free-for-all, really. And we saw the first sort of year of decline since that legislation. We hope that's the beginning of a trend. We know that most of the young people who vape here do so infrequently. So it's weekly or monthly, or they're experimenters. And there's a proportion who are using them, about 10% who are using them daily, and within that, some who are showing signs of dependence. And so we now have to deal with a sort of spectrum of use. At one end, we've got a sort of health response, which is around helping young people who are dependent on nicotine in a vape. And the problem with that dependence is whereby it's affecting their ability to concentrate in school or study, or it's just generally on their mind the whole time and affecting their ability to function normally. To the majority who we need to do much more about helping them navigate the fact that vapes are now out there. They exist. How do they know how to understand the risks? How do they know how to sort of say no? How do they know how to sort of resist trying them and not get sort of swept up into this whole movement? And then I think New Zealand does need to do some work to strengthen our legislation. And I think getting rid of disposables, which are now around 2/3 of youth use, they're very cheap, very low barrier entry, very appealing, as Azrul has said. We just simply don't need things like that, because the costs of having those in the marketplace when their users are kids outweighs any benefit that they might have to help an adult smoker to stop smoking as well.
Hmm. So in New Zealand's case, at least, there is something to work on. There is an actual legislation governing the use of vape, whereas, as Azrul, you've repeatedly mentioned in this conversation, in Malaysia, it's the free-for-all that New Zealand was in before 2020, essentially. At this stage, Azrul, I guess to wrap up the conversation, what is the current progress of the Tobacco Product and Smoking Control Bill in Malaysia? And what would be your call to the government in terms of the actions that needs to be taken to get this legislation through?
Just wanting to share and respond a little bit to what was mentioned by Ben earlier. One of the findings from the most recently launched Adolescent Health Survey 2022, which was just, I think, announced a couple of weeks back by the Ministry of Health, are quite worrying because of some of the factors that Ben mentioned just now in terms of the easy uptake of disposables of vape containing nicotine. The overall prevalence of children aged 13 to 17 currently using e-cigarettes or vape actually rose from 9.8% in 2017 to now almost 15% in 2022. And interestingly, cigarette smoking amongst adolescents survey dropped quite significantly. There are fewer children aged 13 to 17 years of age who have used cigarettes from 13.8% in 2017 to now around 6.2% in 2022. We find that the numbers of vape users who have become newly addicted to nicotine and many of whom have never smoked cigarettes before are actually increasing and starting younger each year. And as you know, adolescents can now regularly be seen, you know, puffing away in restaurants, malls, and even outside school premises. Now, you know, there's no substantial evidence at the moment that is can currently be provided that adult cigarette smokers in Malaysia are switching to vape en masse. You know, it's sort of like a understanding that there's a subtraction. In order to reduce the prevalence of smoking, people will convert or transition to vape. So there's no data yet that this is happening, but it seems for children who smoke, this trend is clearly the case, because they are now looking at vaping as the preferred choice. You know, for kids who need to get the nicotine fix that is more cost effective, stronger than cigarettes, and easily concealed or stored to be used later. And the fact is that smoking stinky cigarettes is really for your granddad or your dad and other old people, you know, but to a school kid, vaping nicotine makes more sense, is cost effective, and is on trend, you know. And this is where we are when it comes to vape, because really, when it comes to tobacco products, this is yesterday's problem. Today, we are seeing more and more problems, and the current legislation or regulatory frameworks are insufficient to be able to address and to be fit for purpose to respond to many of these new innovations and advances in this technology. So where we are in terms of the bill, well, for one thing, the bill has now been renamed the Control of Smoking Product for Public Health Bill 2023. So it's got a new name there. There's been some revision over the original draft, and inputs have been given by MPs and the Parliamentary Select Committee. We have been told that the Cabinet has now approved it for it to be tabled in the upcoming parliamentary session that's going to be in a week's time. So we're looking at being tabled either on the 7th or 8th of June. So there's going to be a huge debate over it, obviously, and there's going to be a lot of these issues that we've discussed be raised by parliamentarians. And to be honest, very often we talk about the social determinants of health, but really in this particular debate, it seems that the commercial determinants of health seem to be more at play. And there's a lot of discussion of how much revenue that the government can obtain from taxing vape, to making it regularized, and less so much of the need to control smoking and vape. And this is something of concern. But the fact is that we need to be able to invest today in order to reap the benefits of the legislation later on. I mean, fewer people who take up smoking and nicotine definitely is preferable. Fewer people who are addicted to nicotine is preferable. Fewer people who suffer from chronic diseases and end up with premature death is definitely something that we should aim to achieve. And we can make that first step of having this legislation be put in place. It should not be business as usual, because Malaysia is facing a serious problem, which we are seeing in other countries like Indonesia. And even in America, where adolescent and children who are taking up vape and being addicted to nicotine is now considered a public health issue. Even in the United Kingdom and also Australia, they've highlighted this particular issue of immense concern. So Malaysia, unfortunately, I think, is really far along on this crisis. And we are starting on the back foot and having to make up for the lost time in terms of dealing with this. And therefore, we need to have the courage to pass this bill that's coming up to be tabled in the first week of June.
Azrul, Ben, thank you both for sharing your insights on the different policy perspectives in addressing tobacco and nicotine addiction. I've been speaking to Ben Yudan, director at the New Zealand nonprofit group Action for a Smoke-Free 2025, and Azrul Muhammad Khalib, CEO of the Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy. This has been The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9.
The BFM Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, 5G now with you.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.